What's poppin', everybody? Hello and welcome to Popcorn Culture. My name is Ben Carlin and I am your host. Here with me today is my brother Jay.
Wow. Not even saying who's in every episode now.
I know.
You get to say Ben Carlin, you're just like my brother Jay. So just let me introduce myself, y'all, here in episode 10. I am Jonathan Carlin.
Wow, you
mostly known as J.
All eight letters. I prefer to think of you as a single letter.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I only spell, if you call me J, it is just the letter J. It is not J-A-Y.
No, you can tell that. There's a difference. Like your name is J.
Right.
And then like we have a friend from college who is named J.
Right.
You know, that's like J-A-Y.
Right, yeah. That was my roommate in college. It was J.
Right, yeah.
But I'm just J.
No, I'm hearing the difference 100%.
Yeah.
No further explanation needed.
Yeah, I think everyone at home is like, why are you even explaining this? It's so obvious.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
They're everybody's like just, y'all are being, wow. It's like explaining the difference between there and there. You know, everyone just knows. Yeah.
The there and there argument, like people who get frustrated when other people use there and there wrong. Like to me at this point in time, it has become so obvious because everybody is frustrated with the exact same grammar problem that anyone who gets it wrong is like accidentally did it. I don't think that people are unknowingly using there and there and there. I think that you hear that last one was T-H-E-Y apostrophe R-E.
I could tell.
Okay, yeah.
I got it. I'm with you.
But no, this is like one of those things where once upon a time, I remember having the difficulty with it because I was like, oh, which one do you use? And then somewhere along the way, I learned it through AOL Instant Messenger or something, and I actually started getting like my grammar correct. But then once you start getting it correct and you see someone get it wrong, it does feel like this weird, I don't even know what it is. It's like, how could you mess that up?
Here's the only way I ever remember it is if you're talking about here or there, then you just spell out the word here in there, like T-H-E-R-E. That's here or there.
Here or there.
And then if it's not that, and it's also not they are, then it's the other one.
Then it's the other one.
T-H-E-I-R.
Okay. Wait, no, I thought T-H-E-I-R is like possessive.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah.
That's
the only one left. I couldn't describe to you the usage. It's just process of elimination. She's like, I'm not talking about something over there, and it's not they are, so it's E-I-R. There it is. You can get it right every time. Although, I totally agree with your point that if and when I inevitably just make this mistake because I'm laying in bed sending a tweet using the word there and someone corrects me, I'm just like, just stop. Did that stop you from understanding what I meant? The answer is no. The language was communicated effectively. If you are reading it and getting so caught off guard, like, well, now wait a minute, though. He means they are, but he didn't write that, so I don't understand this anymore. And she's like, yeah, right? Because that's not your experience. You know what it is. It's just like ticking some annoying like cog in your brain that you need to just like, you've inserted that cog there, and you need to take that cog out and just let it ride.
No, and that's exactly my point, though. That is precisely what I'm saying, is that I think that this is almost like a triggering thing for people where it has reached a point where enough people know it to where, like, in those circumstances where somebody messes it up, it has become, like, almost this, like, blown out of proportion thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, so everything you just said, you started by saying, like, just like, you know what I mean? To me, literally, when someone corrects me, I just say the words, just, like, and then I trail off, you know? It's like,
This is our dad used to say to us, hear what I mean, son.
Yes, that is exactly what he said.
Just hear what I mean.
Hear what I mean. And it was one of these things where if we were we were not bad about it, but like if we were being a bratty know-it-all kid and he asked us to do something, I was like, well, technically.
Yeah.
It's like he would basically just be saying the version of like, you know what I'm asking you to do.
Right, yeah. Hear what I mean. Hear what I mean. I think I gave our dad a real Southern accent just now, which he does not have.
Yeah, not even at all. He is from the North and is a TV news anchor, therefore has like just a very neutral voice.
Right, very non-regional diction.
Do you think that we, and this is a question for the colonels at home as well, do you think that we have like a Southern like undertone to our voice a little bit?
Oh, I think we must, but I think compared to many people who live in our neck of the wood, that we do not.
There's just the one tree. In case people are wondering why I said the neck of the wood.
The neck of the tree.
there's one tree nearby. Every once in a while, if you're lucky enough, you can get one of the golden apples that grows on it.
they're so tasty.
It's amazing.
So tasty. That would be an interesting question to hear, because my assumption is that people who live more south of us think we don't, and people who live at all north of us think we do.
Sure.
And people who live west of us think we do.
Okay, so the big thing that I know that I say all the time that I think is considered Southernish is saying the word y'all.
No, y'all is a fantastic solution
to you all.
To the, what is it? Second person plural, right?
Yes.
That it is a fantastic solution because nobody says you all or you guys or you guyses or whatever. Like, that all sounds stupid. And not only that, because the alternate is you guys, right?
You guys.
And there's already a sentiment against just the word guys for plural groups of people.
Yes, of
because,
course.
Because, like, I think I've described it or heard it described before that, like, a stadium full of 79,000 women and, like, one man is guys.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure,
so,
sure.
And it should not be. And that's stupid. So, guys, y'all is just better because it's gender neutral.
Oh, it is. It is. Yeah. No. And so I love it. I love it. I would be a huge advocate for the word y'all. The other thing that I have gotten before is mixed reactions to, like, so I feel like we were brought up saying, like, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, yes or no, sir.
Yeah.
And one thing in particular that I think gets people is like, and I will say this to everybody, mm-hmm. like all the time. And if I say yes, ma'am to someone very, very, very frequently, I think it comes off as if I'm suggesting that this person is much older.
No, yes. And there's such a terrific irony in that, because from their point of view, you're being very impolite when what you're doing is what was part of, like, politeness training as a child.
Right. It's like I took a class on how to be polite, and this was, like, one of the things in the class.
Right.
Like, I'm not attempting. So, yeah, that's another question to throw out there to people is, if you are referred to as ma'am or sir, does it make you feel older?
This is an interesting one. I'm just thinking about it, just thinking out loud here. Don't have any basis for this. But to me, I would bet that ma'am makes people feel older in a way that sir does not. Like, and I could be totally wrong. It feels like the kind of thing where, like, ma'am indicates older woman, whereas sir indicates some sort of, like, distinguished man or something.
Oh, like because of where and when these words would have been sourced,
mm-hmm.
that is more likely what the original versions of it would have been going back to saying the beginning.
Maybe not. Maybe that's how it's evolved. I don't think that's where it started.
Okay. Interesting.
But it's interesting how, because you'd think politeness would be, like, pretty universal through generations, but it's interesting that, like, the things you learned, like to say yes, ma'am, which would have just been considered generally accepted politeness when we were a kid,
right,
would now come across as potentially impolite and insensitive as an adult.
Right, which is strange.
Mm. Or do you think, okay, interesting thought, do you think if you say as an adult, yes ma'am to someone, it's less acceptable than if, say, a 6-year-old boy said yes ma'am or something?
Oh, interesting. Okay, so like almost even allowing the age disparity to exist in the way that it needs to for this hierarchical, I don't even know if that's a word.
Right.
But you know, if like you're trick or treating and you're age 6 and, you know, you show up to your wife Beth's house, you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
Show up to my house.
My wife, who is 31, hands you a piece of candy.
And that 5-6-year-old kid says, thank you, ma'am.
Right.
Like, is it much more acceptable because the distance between the 6-year-old and the 31-year-old, it's like 25 years versus if I am at Starbucks as a 30-year-old man and there is a 27-year-old barista and I say, thank you, ma'am.
Right.
Like, it's almost, is that what you're saying?
My feeling is that if a kid says it, you know they have just been taught how to be polite and they're just sort of parroting that from
right.
their
yes,
parents.
Yes,
and
of
you
course.
Just like appreciate what a polite kid.
Right. Like
they're doing the things right.
It's even closer to when you would have learned, like when you would have gone through politeness training.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Whereas as an adult, the perception on the receiving end must be like you have decided it's no longer just a matter of like this is just reactionary politeness. This is determined a politeness via determination.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And you have determined them to be ma'am and therefore old.
Okay, so the thing that on this note that I do have absolutely no idea why there are like mental walls in my head about it is specifically like with Alice and the determination to call her like where it would have previously been the girl that I'm dating
mm-hmm.
to now the sentiment or that I never would have said the woman that I'm dating. Oh. I would always say the girl that I'm dating is Alice, not the woman that I'm dating is Alice.
Interesting.
And I have absolutely no idea when or how or where in the process I would start to differentiate which word I was selecting to describe, you know, like if I'm at the grocery store and I'm in the parking lot and I'm pulling out of my parking spot and somebody like, you know, pulls their buggy out behind me or something like that. It'd be like, oh, this woman like pulled out behind me. For some reason I reach for it under that circumstance. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I don't know why, or have you like, if you're referring to Beth as someone, do you say like, I guess I don't even know how to, it feels awkward.
Okay. I'm going to just flip the tables here.
Okay.
And be like, do you think Alice would have described you as the man she was dating?
No. No, definitely you were not a man. No, absolutely not. I am 100% sure that she would have said the guy I'm dating.
Right, the guy.
I would be willing to bet $37.63 that at no point in time has she ever referred to me as like the man she's dating.
Right.
Or the man she's married to.
Right. I think we have all brought that up, like with our generation, as like man and woman, I feel like are phrases that describe older people.
I think so. You know? Yeah. More, like almost, and maybe that's how people are reacting when I say ma'am to them.
Yeah, that
is
be,
like
yeah.
They think that that's what I'm saying.
But that being said, it's not as though like you do a bunch of like typically manly things.
Me?
Like, yeah, like
I
you do
manly
tons of
things.
Like yard work, and you know you can install the plumbing and stuff. Like
sure.
you've got a vast variety of tools and things like that.
I'm honored. I'm honored. Yeah. I think.
You think?
I don't even know. Is this a compliment or an observation?
But there's a weird thing that goes, like, man is such a, there's certain connotations with that in so many different, like, if you're like a real, like, manly man, that feels like someone who's, like, lives in the wood and chops wood and,
a chops wood
know,
is always what is, comes to my know, mind,
it's
yeah.
Like, it's like hunting and,
like the type of person,
like grizzly.
The type of person who actually not only owns an axe, but sharpens it.
Mm.
Like, on like a regular occasion.
And shaves
like,
with it.
They have like a... They have like a well-maintained axe. Okay, so this is so like you say like I like do like quote unquote manly type things. Somewhere along the way, one of my friends was renting a house that was like 100 acres of land,
mm-hmm.
and. It, to me, I was like, oh my God, this is going to be so much fun. We're going to have like all these woodland adventures.
Yeah.
And so somewhere along that way, I went and bought like my first chainsaw.
Yeah.
And so one of the things, and this is like, I do think that I felt pretty cool going in. I bought a Steel, that's STIHL, Steel chainsaw, which is a good one.
which to the non-educated man probably just sounds like a really heavy chainsaw.
It's made of steel.
No.
It is so hard to move, very ineffective. The speed at which I realized I drastically knew nothing about chainsaws mm-hmm. happened like within 36 hours of purchasing it.
Okay.
Because basically they lived in this house and it was the only source of heat was like a wood burning stove. And so because it was 100 acres of woods, we were able to go out and find a dead tree and like take it down so that we could chop it up and turn it into firewood.
Mm-hmm.
And upon getting out there, in my mind, it's like, sure, you walk up, you take the chainsaw to the side of the tree, and it falls over. Not so.
Not how it works?
There is a whole process into the way in which you have to, like, notch the tree and then cut it from the opposite side so that it falls, like, in the direction of the notch.
Yeah.
And that is, like, a whole thing.
Yeah.
So I'm standing out there with my shiny new chainsaw and neither of us neither of us has any idea what we're doing. It is a dead tree, just for full clarification. It is like there are no branches on it. It's just a really tall log that's roots are still in the ground. And so we're attempting to notch it. So like, you know, we cut like a little pie crust piece out of one side and we're going through, and then because of the way the tree is leaning, it just pinches onto my chainsaw. So it is like stuck. Like not going anywhere, pinned into this, like, I mean, I don't even know how heavy it the whole entire like log was like 1,200 pounds.
My God, do you know what I think it's really easy to underestimate is the weight of a tree?
Yeah.
It looks like just a real tall stick, and you can pick up sticks no problem.
I do it all the time.
Yeah. Man, is a tree not just a real long stick?
Until you're actually going to, especially in this capacity, like interacting with the tree. The other thing is, it is immensely dangerous, like cutting down a tree, because if it falls on you, like it is, like you are going to be seriously hurt, if not killed. Not to mention, you're also coming at it with a steel chainsaw.
Yeah, you also have weaponized or mechanized weaponry to an extent with you. I think lumberjacking has one of the least attractive death rates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is not entirely surprising. Although, if you want some really good Instagrams to follow, I wish I had a good name right offhand, but watching lumberjack Instagrammers is crazy, because the guys who like literally climb up the tree and then cut off like a tree-sized piece of a huge tree from the top. And like, they're literally up there and they've got like a GoPro on and they're like using the chainsaw from like, you know, your chest to the tree width apart, and like they can fell them perfectly. It's amazing. Anyway, so in our particular instance, though, we are we're out there, and we knew enough to buy this like wedge, which is basically like a hard piece of plastic that, in the event that this very thing happens, you can like hammer the wedge into the tree to get the tilt to go the other way. So we actually had multiple of them, and we had a sledgehammer. And so we hammered like five of these wedges into it, trying to get my chainsaw out, which was not working. Finally, Steven, my friend, basically was able to just like get like one hit, the whole thing went, and chainsaw fell out and the tree went down, and we started, you know, cutting it up to bring it down to cut it for wood. So the next thing I very quickly figure out is that sharpening a chainsaw is like brushing your teeth. Like, it's not the type of thing that you do like once.
Oh.
You know, and then you're good.
Right.
It's like, you have to do it all the time.
I see.
And that's, and so I'm sitting there with my brand new chainsaw, and it's taking me like 30 minutes to cut through this log.
Oh,
because
gosh.
It is so dull so quickly from where I basically had the one, you know, right off the shelf that probably wasn't, you know, I don't know, maybe it was supposed to be sharp. Maybe I just ruined it by not knowing what I was doing. All of the above seem like likely situations.
Yeah.
But yeah, so as much as I think that I felt like a cool guy, manly dude, the moment I was buying my chainsaw, it immediately was like, I know nothing, Jon Snow.
That's funny. That so often you can be humbled by what you assume to be a simple task.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But I also think it's interesting that how many different meanings the word like manly, I feel like, can kind of take on.
Sure.
Because you could be like some like gruff woodsman, but I feel like you would probably call most like, you know, typical biker guys like real manly. And that's like within the same genre. But then you would also, I think, you know, if you were like a high powered like lawyer or politician or something, like there's a certain amount of like manliness about that. Like, that's a kind of man.
Sure, you know? Sure.
Or I think, like, even just there's a certain manliness to, like, parenthood or, you know, husband stuff, you know?
There is no two ways about it. I think that is one of those things that even watching you become a dad has been one of the most eye-opening experiences ever, watching, like, your parenting. And I'm like, constantly impressed.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, of course. because I'm like, man, this is like my brother who I've known my whole life, who is now like doing things that like, not that I never would have imagined you doing, because I always assumed you would be a dad. But like watching them come out, like watching you, you know, like tend to Luke or change a diaper or, you know, like handle the screaming baby, like all these things. It's like the caregiver element of you absolutely does fall, I think, into this same exact category, which is, I would argue, not the stereotype, but may as well should be, because it's awesome.
Well said, brother.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well said. Okay, Ben, we have to touch on some stuff here. Some stuff from some other episodes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's do it.
So first of all, as we record this, it is February 10th, which means that this week, by the time people hear this, it will have already been Ihsan Van Pavia Day.
He's on Papaya Day?
Is February it? Friendsgiving.
Hold on. Does this episode come out on the... It does!
Oh, happy Easton Papaya Day!
Oh my gosh, everybody. All the colonels of the world.
Little colonels.
Happy Easton Easton... Oh no, I've had it so well. Easton Papaya Day?
Easton Papaya Day.
Yeah, that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
February Friendsgiving.
Yeah, in case anybody needs a quick refresher, what you should be doing with your day today is getting together with all of those friends who you choose to include in your life, because this is our problem. As much as I love seeing family, and as much as you need a good reason to see them, I feel like on Thanksgiving, it's this strange thing where you go and you spend your entire holiday with like not the people who you regularly choose to occupy, you know, to spend your time with.
Right.
We need a day for that.
And
we didn't need Valentine's Day.
We didn't need Valentine's Day. It's gone.
It's gone.
And we say that not as like single people who are jaded, but as married people who are still kind of like, what? I don't, whatever.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Which I will say is not just, I don't think me and Ben's opinion, well, I can't speak for Alice, but Beth is often just like, whatever. She's not like a big Valentine's Day girl.
Okay. So I asked Alice about
woman.
This. Way to get yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ma'am.
Now I'm going to hear it from Beth. You're like, don't call me woman.
It's so true. Oh, goodness. So I asked Alice about this over the weekend. We were driving around, and I was telling her about this new holiday that we've invented, which she thought was genius. And so I was like, what's your take on it? Because she owns, and we've talked about it before, like a bridal shop, and she has flowers. So this week is like a huge week for someone who owns a flower shop, because there are tons and tons and tons of orders that come in for, obviously, you know, roses and stuff to be delivered on Valentine's Day. We know someone, fortunately.
Yeah.
And so my question for her, though, because we have had very intermittent Valentine's Days, like where a couple of them we've done nothing. I think there was like 1 year where I gave her like one of each of the classic things, like, you know, a stuffed creature, a box of chocolates, and
dozen roses
and flowers or something. Yeah. So I sort of did like all the normal things. And then like last year, I think for the girls, we gave is like when we told them we were taking another trip to Disney. So that was like a weird excuse to go all out on it.
Right.
But that obviously would sort of be like an anomaly over the wavelength of how we normally handle it. And so I was asking her, because I actually didn't know the answer to it. Like, do you like celebrating Valentine's Day, or is it something that you can be, you know, excited about? Or do you like, I don't know, whatever, because you spend your whole day delivering flowers to like half the people in our area.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she did not want to admit this to herself at all. But I do think that she was like, I do kind of like doing something.
Okay.
Doing something.
All right.
So I was like, okay, I need to have a plan. So as of you guys hearing this, hopefully I figured that plan out, because as of present, I do not know.
Well, the other thing you need to be planning out, Ben, is where are you going to be getting your French fries from?
My French fries?
Because the other half of Easton Papaya Day, February Friendsgiving, is that everyone has to come over and bring their favorite French fries.
AKA Friends fries.
Friends fries. Exactly.
Yes.
So
yes.
I think we described it earlier as you have to cook as many oven trays as you have worth of French fries.
Have any idea how many oven trays I have?
I know you have a lot.
I have been baking pretty hard lately, so I have quite the collection.
Okay. See, this is why we started drafting. We went through a few rounds of February Friendsgiving.
Right.
And I think the better way to do it is to obviously you got to include all your friends in the giving part, and what you're all giving each other is the fries from your favorite fry establishment.
Fry establishment.
Fry establishment.
Great word. Great word.
Yeah. But so where do you have a place that you think serves the best French fries?
Ooh.
French fries.
So probably my favorite friend fries in Roanoke, Virginia right now is at a place called Martin's, and they have twisted steak fries, which are like steak fries, but twisted. And they're delicious.
They are good.
I would say that I think those are up there. Second place, in case you're visiting Roanoke, Virginia, and you're looking for a good place to go, Wall Street Tavern also has these like Parmesan something fries.
Mm-hmm.
And they're mega super deep fries. They've got like a nice like crackly, crusty, bubbly exterior that has like a nice like crunch bite to it, you know?
Crunch bite.
Yeah, like you need like a good fry if it like has like a good crunchy exterior, but then like the interior is still soft.
Mm-hmm.
Like you don't want the whole thing to be crunchy.
Or soft.
Or soft. Definitely not all soft.
Not all mush.
Like an undercooked, what is it called? A fry that has ridges. It's kind of like a frozen food aisle French fry. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Like a ruffle fry, kind of?
Maybe like a ruffle fry.
That's the wrong word.
I feel like a ruffle fry. I don't know what a ruffle fry.
Like a wavy cut fry.
A wavy cut fry?
Yeah.
An undercooked wavy cut fry is my least favorite
fry. It's like it was a frozen fry, and this is the one that had all the freezer burn on it. So all the other fries are nice and crispy and great, but this one just got soggy because it had too much ice on it.
It is the Hot Pockets of French fries.
Mm, yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for understanding. Where were we headed with this?
We were just trying to figure out where has the best French fries.
And where are your favorite French fries?
Okay. So I shall list two places. Here in the Roanoke. I want to say there's some really good fries at this place called Beamer's.
Oh, Beamer's.
Yeah,
they have really good fries. Describe the fries for the folks at home.
Well, you can get like these garlic Parmesan fries, and I don't know if I could say much more. They're not wavy crust. Do they have the skin on them still? They look like hand cut fries.
I think they're truffle oil.
Truffle oil Parmesan garlic fries.
What is a truffle oil? Is that an oil that is surmised from a mushroom?
Well, truffles, I think, are a kind of mushroom, so they must be pressing them to get the oil out.
Goodness me. Well, I am looking up at kitchenswagger.com.
Yeah.
Baked Parmesan truffle fries recipe. And if I could make anything that even looks remotely like this picture, then it would be what I would bring to Friendsgiving.
Friend
Isan van Pavia Day.
Yeah. So I think it's important to note, if you're planning your own Isan van Pavia Day, February Friendsgiving, is that if you want to make your own fries, highly encouraged, go for it. However, don't feel like that is like excluding you. If you want to, I think part of it, you just go to your favorite fry joint, just get a big old order, show up. It could be McDonald's fries.
You know what? I think there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, what I would really like to see is if you went through a drive-thru and just said, just put as many fries as you can in a bag,
yes,
and I'll meet you at that window.
Oh.
Like, I want to see what people would get.
I have a new answer.
Okay.
Okay, this is maybe my more fries you can get around the country answer.
Okay, around the globe.
Around the country, in case you don't live in Roanoke, Virginia.
Chances are they don't.
Yeah, chances are you don't. Some of you will, certainly.
Thanks, Mom.
Oh, man. Five Guys.
Ooh, Five Guys.
Five Guys fries.
I feel like Five Guys has what I would define as like a purist fry. It is like I think they literally have bags of potatoes about when you walk in. And I think that they have a fry press, which is kind of like a grid thing that you put the tater in,
mm-hmm,
and then it's kind of like a can crusher. Do you remember a can crusher from when we were kids?
Dude, a can crusher is one of the best things you can own, and we owned one as kids, and I'd have never brought up can crusher with anyone who also knew what it was.
Really?
No one.
Goodness me, I loved our can crusher.
Dude, me too.
Well, what the funniest thing about this is I've dropped this in conversation with friends before, mm-hmm, and it's like, it costs like $14, and for some reason I won't buy my own.
Yeah, I don't understand.
I need a can crusher. Is what it comes down to.
I think part of the fun of it when we were kids, if you don't know what a can crusher is, this was like a thing mounted to the wall.
Yeah.
And basically when you finish drinking something out of an aluminum can, like a Sprite or a Coca-Cola, or at our house, probably a Diet Coke.
That's what
at our house growing up, not at my house now, but our mom loves Diet Coke. If you ever want to send her some, we have a P.O. box. We'll get it to her. Big on the Diet Coke. But so anyway, we had one bin in particular that was solely for aluminum cans to go in.
Yes, because we had a really cool recycling place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where they would just, I guess you just go weigh it and they would just pay you for it or something.
That's exactly it. Yeah. So it was, and I think that's how Dad motivated us to do it. I mean, you'd be talking about 12 can crushed can bags and we would get $11 split three ways.
Is that right?
I think so.
That's not much.
The yield was minimal.
But the point of the can crusher is to be able to fit more cans into the bin.
Which we did.
But in the meantime, until you take them to the place to get your $11. I want to say you'd be in Ty would come up with, it's like having a whole giant trash can full of sharp metal objects to play with.
For kids.
Sticky sharp metal objects. But man, would we.
We did.
I think we would, like, this must have been so annoying to our parents. We would dump them out all the time. Because they'd, like, I think we had, like, a hockey stick, and we would use it as, like, a, like, you'd, like, shoot the cans into the back into the trash can.
That is a fact.
Or else, like, you know, like, beer pong them back in, like, as if it was a giant basketball hoop.
Right, right. Yeah. We did, yep. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
I have not, these memories are so, like, far hidden away in, yeah, my, in my brain desk that it's amazing to relive them.
Well, there you go. I'm glad I'm unlocking really old memory orbs from deep and long-term memory. I'm imagining the little jelly beans in your brain from inside out are like, where are we going?
He has not been here.
Quadruple Z.
In years.
Hey, oh, man.
We were ready to delete them.
We were ready to delete them. Yes. Like, yeah. it's a long trip for them.
It is.
Long
it
trip
is.
For those little jelly beans. But, yeah, so if you, too, want your kids to have a giant just bin of sharp, sticky, crushed cans, a can crusher is for you. But in the meantime, it's so satisfying because all you just put your can in there and you pull a lever and it is, like, crushed down so tiny.
So tiny. Okay.
So tiny.
Do you remember there was one thing in particular about our home can crusher that drove me nuts? And I want to know if you know what it is. Without me explaining it.
Was it that it was, like, at foot level?
Okay, that's part of it. Because Dad totally installed this with us in mind. I'm 100% sure that he did not intend to crush the cans.
No.
Because he literally installed it at the height of someone's shin.
Yeah. He might have bent over
right, like,
to do this.
There was plenty of wall in that room where it could have gone. And that's where he chose to put it. The other thing was we had baseboard heat.
Yeah.
And so the handle would come down.
Your fist would hit the heater.
It would hit the heater. And it was like, it was so, like you almost felt like you could have crushed the cans a little bit more,
mm-hmm.
except the handle ran into the baseboard heat.
Yeah.
And so that was just annoying. And we dealt with it, I guess, because it never really slowed us down. We did it all the time.
All the time. We had, like, a babysitter who would come over and, like, drink a beverage solely so she could use the can crusher.
Yeah, that
so,
was a thing.
So, let me just tell you guys, if you're sitting there like, why would anyone want a can crusher? What is the point? Let me just tell you, if you're like, man, can I consume more beverages? It will motivate you and your kids to just plow through any canned drink you have in the house because the joy of crushing a can with a can crusher.
Plus, recycling.
Yeah. Yeah, recycling.
Okay, we'll put a link to a can crusher
as an afterthought
in the show notes, so that everybody can go and get their own can crusher.
Mm-hmm.
And you can and should and must tweet us a photo of your first crushed can.
Yes,
because I'm so excited to see what people do. I want to know how many people do it.
I'm very excited to see pictures of that and of your Isla Mompavia Friendsgiving gatherings.
Yes.
Yeah.
That too.
I want to see that. No. Okay. Before we move on, let me just say, back to Five Guys.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
their wonderful French fries and barrels full of peanuts. One of the things, whenever people start talking about, like, best fast food burgers, there's always this East Coast, West Coast battle. Do you know the two restaurants upon which I am discussing?
I feel like the West Coast is In-N-Out Burger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the East Coast, which is the Beast Coast.
Yeah.
It's
Shake Shack.
Shake Shack. That is exactly what it is. We don't have one near us.
We don't have one near us. We have a Steak and Shake.
We have
It's just not the same. My wife, Beth, it would frustrate her to no end that I could not remember the difference between Shake Shack and Steak and Shake, to which I'm like, are you kidding? They not only do they both serve milkshakes and hamburgers, but they have the word shake in their name.
Right.
Like, it's so easy.
I've already forgotten which one is which. What do we have?
We have Steak and Shake.
Steak and Shake.
We have Steak
which
and Shake.
Which is not good.
Which is, it's okay.
Okay, it's fine.
It's fine.
Said the little dog in the burning house.
It's fine. We don't have Shake Shack, which is the East Coast's answer to In-N-Out Burger on the West Coast, which has no available rhyme to compete with the East Coast, which is the Beast Coast. But let me tell you, people argue themselves hoarse about whether or not they like In-N-Out Burger or Shake Shack. And let me just tell everyone, let me definitively answer this argument for you.
Uh-oh, here it comes.
The answer...
Strong opinions about things that don't matter. Go ahead.
...is that Five Guys is better than both of them by a mile.
A full 5,280 feet.
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not even close. Why are people even discussing, I don't understand.
I can tell you're worked up.
Five Guys exists on both coasts and it's way better.
Yes. No, yeah. I do. We have had both. Okay, so I remember with having our strange YouTube careers, we have made more trips to LA than I ever expected to make in my life.
Mm.
And as a result, inevitably, there was the, should we go to In-N-Out Burger?
Yeah.
And I was like, I've heard such good things. Let's do it. And I certainly don't want to like tell anybody, like, I don't quite get it, I think is literally what my reaction to this is. Like, it is...
Perfectly adequate.
Perfectly adequate, yeah. is a fine way to put it. But like, I don't think even minus going into it with high expectations, I would have walked out of there and been like, dude, what an underrated burger.
Yeah.
And how are you supposed to get it? Like all the way?
Animal style.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I have done every variation of it, and I largely feel like it's an okay-ish burger. On the other hand, we were in New York City,
yep.
which is when we went to Steak Shack.
Shake Shack. So you're also messing it up.
I don't know what it's called.
Shake Shack.
To which my main issue is that actually in town there is a burger joint called Jack Brown's, which I think has the exact same burger that is better here. And so while I actually think that out of those two, I would prefer the East Coast, which I'm not going to try again. Shake Shack?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not even kidding. So Shake Shack, I think, is better than In-N-Out Burger, which I think both of which are worse than Jack Brown's, which I think is on par with Five Guys, which is available everywhere.
There you go. So the answer is everyone needs to stop their belly aching about Shake Shack versus In-N-Out Burger and just go to Five Guys and you'll just be happier.
You'll just be happier. A happier soul.
The next time this comes up, and it will, you can just own the conversation and be like, Five Guys.
Done.
Out. Done. Mic drop.
And then everybody will have way more time on their hand to go and enjoy their meal.
They will.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Okay.
Anyway, we have been to the Shake Shack in New York City where the whole chain started.
Oh, we have been to the one.
I don't know if it grew from a specific restaurant, but we've been to the one in New York City.
Okay.
The chain started in New York City. I don't know if it's the one.
Right.
It's the one near Broadway.
Yes.
We've been there.
Do you remember while we were there, we met a nice family who found out that we were YouTubers, had no idea who we were, but thought it was so cool they wanted to take a picture with us anyway.
I do remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that was the oddest exchange ever. It's like, oh, you're important. Let's take a picture.
We could have been lying. Could have. We weren't.
On that note, okay,
we're also not important.
This is a very unnecessary tangent, but I do think it's one of the funniest things ever. One of the first ever meet and greets we did was at a conference, maybe VidCon, somewhere along the way.
I don't know what story you're going to tell, so I can't confirm which one you're going to talk about.
Okay, so we were in a group where we were actually put in like last minute.
This is playlist.
Playlist live. Yeah. Okay.
In Orlando.
And so we were in a group with a whole bunch of like prankster YouTubers and then it was us. And so,
but we didn't know that.
We did not know
until we showed up. Like the guy who hooked it up for us was like, you guys want a meet and greet? And we're like, absolutely. And we show up and it's real obvious what has happened.
Someone dropped out.
Yeah. Someone dropped out of the prankster meet and greet. And he was like, I got guys who can fill you.
Right. So with the idea here being that roughly speaking, maybe if you like this particular prankster YouTuber, chances are you're also familiar with these other four people
right.
who also do prankster videos and then us. And so during that, we actually ended up having plenty of people that came through who knew us and it was fantastic and they were all amazing. But at the very, very, very least, there was one person who came through, and it's so funny in situations like this because I think the people coming through the line, meeting the, you know, the quote unquote celebrity, the talent, is just as aware of the circumstances as we are.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, I'll take a picture with you. Like almost as if like they were doing it to like make us not feel awkward. Like,
right.
Like they were like, don't worry, I got you. Like I'll make this okay. I'll take a picture with you. Like make you feel important.
Don't give me that pity pic.
Well, it worked out because there was one girl who we met and we took a picture with who had no idea who we were. And then like 2 years later, I remember she tagged us in the photo and she was like, oh my gosh, I became a huge fan of this YouTube channel called the Super Carlin Brothers and I wanted to meet them for so long. And I was digging through my photo my phone the other day and it turns out I already have.
That's hilarious.
And I
It was that girl.
It was that girl.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
So we had met someone they came through, had take a pity picture with us, and ultimately just like not even related to that event,
right,
became fans of the channel and then realized that they had already met us, which I thought forever that has been like, I wish I even knew the person's name, but it's like one of the more hilarious interactions we've had with anybody.
I was so nervous when we did that meet and greet that's how, because of how we got in all the prankster things. So yeah, the way a lot of these meet and greets at cons work is you'll meet like a group of creators at once. So you sign up like with which group you want to meet.
Right.
So you're going to meet like five people or five channels or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, we were like this fandom channel, and then it was four prank channels.
Right.
Yeah. So, and gosh, because the first person that the people were going to meet was clearly of the other prank channels, the big one.
The one that's the most well known. Yeah.
He probably should have been at the end of the line.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I will say that if you're organizing a conference, you want the most popular person to be at the end.
Right. So that everybody comes through.
Everyone
the
comes
whole
through.
Thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Because what happened was that because he was easily the most popular person in that meet and greet, the people who were really excited to see him were the most excited like people there. So like the first maybe 10 people in line were there. They were the biggest fans of the biggest person there, and they got there early.
Right.
And they didn't care about meeting anyone else. So the first like 10 people come through and we're like, God.
Yeah. It was definitely like a major, major humbling moment where I was like it was such an honor to be asked to do like a meet and greet, like as if like other people in the industry had perceived enough demand for us to be there that like, that like we had this thing. And then it was like, this is the exact opposite of how I thought this was going to go. Like I thought that this was going to be this like, I don't know, feeling special moment, and instead it was for the first 15 minutes of it I was like beet red. Terrible. But
eventually, those super fans cleared out. And then I almost think, my recollection is that our last minute inclusion in this particular meet and greet, like, really attracted a lot of people to it.
That otherwise were not fans of Prankster.
The Prankster channels. Yes. Yeah, which that must have been awkward for all of them.
I know. So yeah. the tide shifted a little bit at one point in time.
I do remember, this was the first time we ever did it like this, like the meet and greet at all. And I think, I always remember there was like one little girl in there who, she was there with her parents, and they like, told us they'd flown from Texas specifically so she could meet us. And I was like, there's no way that's true. You were mistaken. We're not the guys. No.
We're not the droids you're looking for.
Yeah, I don't...
Oh man, that's so funny. And interestingly, even on the same token, so we've done like a meetup series now, like across the country, where we've been to like Chicago and Washington D.C. and Salt Lake City and a few different places where we like rent out a movie theater and people come and like watch the movies with us. Probably the people listening, I think, are the ones aware that that we do this. The very first one we ever did.
Oh yeah.
The funny thing about it was we had our friend Seamus Gorman, who is like a fellow Harry Potter Pixar theorist on YouTube, was in town to come and do like a Spartan race with us and to sort of be like a part of the event. And so we're like super nervous about the whole thing because it is the first one we've ever put on.
Yeah.
No idea what to expect. We're like scrambling, like people who weren't even like signed up as volunteers ended up like working the whole event and not watching the movie and being phenomenal. So the behind the scenes was just pure noise and mayhem. And then, you know, of course this like first person walks up and the very first person who's ever come to a Supercar Carlin Brothers meet and greet is like, I'm actually just here to meet Seamus. Yeah. And it was like, it's what cool. has happened? Like, I think the fear, again, I went straight back to that first moment and I was like, oh no.
Yeah, I remember that moment. And there was like, oh boy, I hope like this is going to be awkward.
Yeah, yeah.
But not if you like Seamus more than us, that's totally fine.
But, oh yeah, no, of course, perfectly acceptable. Yeah. That I take no issue with.
Yeah.
But in the event that you came to this specific event, which was definitely set up and advertised as a Super Carlin Brothers meetup, where we had like a space, like a table, you know, that Seamus was like hanging out at.
Yeah.
I think that you may have been, may have not been what you were expecting for that one kid. Anyway, the rest of the day went fine.
Anyway, good day. Super good day. All right, Ben. So I see we got a lot of feedback from people who, in fact, knew people who were on reality shows.
Yes. Okay. I was very excited about this. The strange thing about having any sized audience whatsoever is like being able to ask so many people a question that I desperately want the answer to be yes to.
Mm-hmm.
And people came through a little bit.
Yeah.
Like people knew people, which I thought was fascinating. And it was even interesting to me. A lot of the people who wrote back, and specifically if they knew like a Bachelor contestant, the way that they described someone who I absolutely know who they are is like, they would like give me like all this like additional background, like they were the person who did this or whatever. It's like, oh, I know who that is. Like I know exactly who that is. But it was kind of fascinating because one person did actually know a villain from one season, or at least what the show turned into a villain.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought this one was kind of interesting because when you sign up to do like a reality TV show, one of the things that you do have to sign into is like they can present you in a negative light.
Right.
And that is something that like when you go on the show, I mean, they may not be targeting you specifically, but if they can build a narrative around you being the bad guy, they're going to do it.
There's going to be a bad guy.
And you did agree to it.
Right.
And so the one person wrote in that actually knew Luke P.
Oh gosh. That's from the last season of The Bachelorette with Hannah Brown.
Hannah Brown,
who ABC just loves.
Yes, they
put her on everything.
Absolutely. Yeah, she like won Dancing with the Stars. She was The Bachelorette. And
yeah.
She has now made several appearances in the current season of The Bachelorette. Yeah, I'm not even 100% sure that she's not who he ends up with, even though she's not on this season. And I'm saying that like somewhat jokingly, but also like kind of seriously.
But, like, wouldn't be surprised if she shows up at After the Final Rose or whatever.
Something.
Yeah.
Something like I don't that. Think it's over.
But her season of The Bachelorette may as well have just been about the villain.
Luke P. Okay, so he basically, he came on and Hannah really, like, seemed to like him in a way that all of the other guys just could not comprehend.
Right.
And it's so hard to know what's going on behind closed doors. And, of course, you know, we only see what the camera shows us. And if they're spinning a narrative, then we're going to see that.
Uh-huh.
But apparently this person said that they don't know them personally, but they did know that their perception of them coming from their hometown was that they were like that Luke was a super nice person,
mm-hmm.
who went on to be on the show that was then spun to be a villain. So I don't know. I thought that was just kind of interesting, mm-hmm. in and of itself, specifically to know someone who caught so much negative spotlight.
Oh, yeah.
Now, moving on to a note from Michaela. This one was kind of interesting just because I thought it was fun. But she said that her and her mom used to watch the show together. And once upon a time, they were like watching it in their living room when all of a sudden on screen, their dad walked on.
That's surprising.
Surprising.
Not dating the woman.
No. But he is a pilot, and he was one of the pilots that was hired to fly the whoever the main contestant was on a date. And so apparently the dad kept it a secret, at least from his daughter, until the episode aired, so that like it could be like a fun surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Which I was like, that's so cool. Like, especially, you know, if you know that like your son or daughter or whatever family member loves a show, and then getting this like be on it,
yeah,
and kind of have that, like,
that's really cool,
that holy crap moment. Yeah,
of course. I'm sure he had to sign a bazillion NDAs and whatever.
I'm sure that's also true.
Yeah.
The other things, okay, so I did some research a little bit about reality TV in general because I wanted to see what types of stories have like floated to the surface, because the NDA thing that you talk about is such a big deal with all of this stuff. We've even done projects before where we've signed NDAs and it's like it's super strict. Like, we can't talk about anything to do with what we did.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting because in order for any of these stories to exist, it probably means that someone broke their NDA and that they were not supposed to tell the story.
Yeah. They've probably leaked it or tried to leak it in a very anonymous way.
Exactly. Right. So it's kind of hard to ever like pair back to it. But the stories that I was seeing is that across the board in a variety of different shows, like House Hunters, for example, is the one that we even got several emails about it. But it sounds like almost nothing to do with House Hunters at all is real.
Oh, like, this is such a thing about reality TV, is that they produce such a narrative for the viewer that's interesting, but which doesn't really happen. And I guess with something like House Hunters, maybe it's not that surprising because, like, you know, for the circumstances of the show to exist, basically the realtor has to find three different houses,
right,
that are all on sale and within the price range and perfect fits for the couple, and the couple has to argue about it and no one else has to be intervening, and, you know, whatever. Like, you basically need a perfect storm of something every single week.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's the thing. And I think having gone through the home buying experience myself and like, you know, putting an offer on my house and then finding out that immediately after I put my offer in, there was like three other ones. It's sort of like the fact that these people are going back and forth and negotiating over days. That's like, that is not how it goes. I don't know a single person who's had an experience like that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure some people have, but it's, yeah, it's what did you learn? Or so describe, first of all, the like how the show typically works and then what you learned to be false about it.
Okay. So the way the show typically works is that you have a couple who has a budget and they're looking for homes, and usually they're going to walk us through them experiencing three different homes.
Okay.
And I think that in general, what you're supposed to do is sort of have like the economy home, the home that's like the right budget, and then like the reacher home that like you probably shouldn't buy, but like has like a cool feature or something right. like that. So there's supposed to be like an obvious like up, down, all around to each of the houses that like is shown.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think at the end, they pick, you know, usually option B, the one that makes the most sense.
Right. Who knew?
Who knew? And I think a huge portion of what I have seen about this is that in some instances, none of it went down at all, and the people don't live there, and they didn't move, and the whole thing was just like entirely an illusion.
Right. Like they had, like to the point where they basically had two actors and three completely not for sale homes, and they just showed off three houses.
Effectively, like the home buying process.
Okay.
Is roughly speaking, in super general terms. Like, I do think that there are people, they're like real people. They're not like actors
right.
on purpose, but effectively they are the talent.
Okay.
For lack of a better way to put it. But so what a lot of people have said is that on that show in particular, people have already bought a house
mm-hmm.
and it is the house that they ultimately end up picking.
Oh, okay.
And that, the rest of what you're watching is entirely built out narrative.
Oh, so like and before the show is even filming, they've already got the house they want.
They've already got the house they want. And typically what one person in particular said is that they were shopping for a vacation home. And after purchasing the home, they were approached by one of these shows to go on it.
Interesting.
So it's like it wasn't even like through the home buying process, like the TV show was involved. It was like they bought a vacation home, and then from there, it was supposed to be like backpedaled out into this.
That's interesting.
Right, like they had already bought it. But then we had one more person, and then I won't go on for too long with it, that gave me a story that they lived in Ontario, and I'm trying to find the specific story here. Okay. So this story, it came from a girl named Cassidy, and it said that her and her dad were on House Hunters in Vancouver. And the reason they remember it is because they live in Ontario, and they live in Ontario, the people that were on the show.
Okay.
And despite doing the House Hunters thing and choosing a house in Vancouver, they still live in Ontario.
Oh.
And she said that this is the first time that she realized just how staged the show actually was, basically. Which, I guess I just find fascinating. Like, to me, it feels like it breaks the rules so badly of telling an interesting story, and that the whole thing is like fabricated in a weird way,
mm-hmm.
which is strange, I think, because when watching any scripted show ever, that is exactly what you're watching.
Right.
It's
the deception.
It's the deception. It's the idea that it is being delivered as quote unquote reality TV, which I think has also fallen into a strange category, because I think most people are aware of how staged it is.
Right.
And yet you still fall for it. You still become engaged.
Let me tell you, the show that this was ruined for me the most was a show called Storage Wars.
Yes.
Which is it still on? I don't even know.
Sure. Yes.
If you don't, yes.
I'm going to wildly declare.
For when we were watching it, it was basically on 24/7. Mm-hmm. It was like super popular. But the point of Storage Wars is that you've got these four people who go around, and they're all sort of at odds with each other, but all sort of like friendly at the same time. And they're
in a way that you can understand almost. Like right. they exist in the same community. They're all the people who are like the legits, and they show up, and they're always in the same places bidding on the same things.
Right. So, but what they're bidding on is abandoned storage lockers.
Right.
So someone rented a locker somewhere, they put all their stuff in it, and then they stopped making payments, and so the company who owns the lockers claims it and is auctioning off the contents or whatever. Storage Wars has your people come in, they open the locker, they can like look, they can't go inside or touch anything, they can just look from the outside and decide whether or not they want to bid on it. And the pull of the show is that they're buying basically a lottery's worth of junk, and maybe there's something of extreme value in there. So can they buy someone's abandoned objects and turn it into fortune, basically?
Or profit, even.
Profit. You know, I bought this storage locker for $500. I'm going to sell this cool item I found for $3,000.
Right.
You know.
Right. It's the dream, basically.
It's the dream. Yeah. And so it's super, it's like a really fun show to watch because what could they find? It could be literally anything.
And I think I even get that. Like, you know, I think I can even, I can so imagine the circumstances where, you know, somebody has the storage unit, they put all this stuff in there. At one point in time, they were like rare baseball card collectors. So there's a shoebox that has that in it.
Right.
You know, and
there's a rookie Mickey Mantle card in there. And oh my God, this is unbelievable.
Right.
Never
could have found it. But then on top of that, you can totally understand how there would also be like an old beaten up couch and a lamp that has like fringe on it and stuff.
So it's a really fun show to watch because they always find something that they have to go get checked out by some appraiser somewhere. And they always know someone who can appraise it at an old antique shop or an old sign shop or something.
Which again, I think like if you're in this industry and you're always buying eclectic stuff, then you probably know those odd people. Like that doesn't stretch my imagination so far that I'm like, okay, you don't know a gold coin guy. It's like, of course you know a gold coin guy.
Yeah, if this is your hobby, you probably do know a coin guy.
Right.
But this is eventually what I learned about the show that made it unwatchable to me.
Oh gosh.
Is that the way the show actually functions is that the people who they go to do the appraising are the people, those people are donating items from their shops to the show to be put in the lockers.
No!
And then the people who bid on them find the object and contact this person they know, and then that store gets exposure on the show. So, like, the stuff they find that they take to the people, those are all plants. And it's like, they're not, I know. It was like, this like wrecked my brain because me and Beth probably we watched this show so much when it was on.
Oh my
god. In like
gosh.
Full force. And it was so like, you're like, the fun of the show is that they're basically opening up a lottery and like either they struck big, they risked it. They, you know, sometimes they get in little bidding wars with each other and you're like, oh, when he forced the guy up to like 3,000. It's really important that he finds something cool in there.
Right. Yeah. Like the stakes are so manageable, but also like very relatable.
Right.
You know, it's like you can, it's not hard to get invested in exactly that concept because it's so straightforward.
Yeah.
It's like, here's a place where there might be a rare thing.
Yeah. And the fun was, you know, whatever they'd find, they'd take it to the appraiser and they'd be like, I know what this is. This came from this kind of factory in this time period of America. And these were hard to find because they were made with this particular thing. And it was like, oh, this is a cool little history lesson about whatever they found.
Right.
But it's like, it's not real. Not real, people.
Ugh.
Yeah. Sorry if you still watch Storage Wars and I just ruined it for you. But I'm not sorry. Wake up, sheeple.
Sheeple. Goodness gracious. Okay. Well, I mean, that was fascinating and I had no idea any of that. That is a super, super interesting insight into. I know you did completely. Is Pawn Stars the same way?
Almost definitely.
Goodness.
Sorry. Let me enunciate that. Almost definitely. Not oh, mostly.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. Almost definitely.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know for sure that that's the case, but I would totally bet that's how Pawn Stars works.
Okay.
And how American Pickers works. I would bet. I don't, now, river monsters? Probably not. You can't really plant the fish.
Where of? Oh, dude, there would be nothing more upsetting. it's like really what they did. They sedated a 400-pound tuna and dropped it in the area. No!
That'd be so terrible. That show was real popular for a hot second. I don't know. That's still on.
Okay, before we sign off, because we're right at that limit. So I want to ask you the question that, are these shows that we're discussing, are they reality TV? Like, what is the difference between, like, a game show and reality TV and, like, House Hunters? Like, is House Hunters reality TV?
Let's see. I think, like, a game show like Jeopardy, not reality TV.
Okay.
A lot of... But then, like, Survivor, for example, it is a game, but it is, I would say, reality show based around a game.
Okay.
And typically, my distinction is if they have like the cutaway confessionals, like the talking heads where they're interviewing the people one-on-one outside the game or whatever.
Yep.
But there are plenty of shows that or game shows that have adopted this just to make the show more engaging. Like if you watch Chopped, they're constantly cutting away to the floating head to describe what was happening in that moment or whatever. But I wouldn't call Chopped a reality show. I would just call it a game show.
Okay, I'm going to give you the quick Google definition of a reality TV show.
Okay.
It says television programs in which real people are continuously filmed, designed to be entertaining rather than informative.
Okay.
Which I think that distinction is kind of interesting because I think you could make the argument that things like Storage Wars, where they might be teaching you about like an old musket.
Yeah.
I think that can be informative, maybe? Or does that not count? Is that still entertainment?
I think, okay. See, Storage Wars falls into a weird category because actually it's all staged, right?
Okay.
The deception is that it is informative when actually it's just entertaining because it's all staged.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay.
So now I don't know. I wouldn't call that reality. I would just call that it's not really a game show either. It's like a, I don't know. I wouldn't say reality. I'm not giving it reality.
Okay.
I'm giving that status.
Okay.
Then you have something like Kardashians. That's through and through reality TV.
That's reality TV.
But I think you have to have the same real, because the Storage Wars people, like the people who are bidding, they must be paid by whatever network
A&E
they're on.
A&E or something.
Like as people to appear on the show.
Okay.
Whereas, let's see, what would be another like sort of towing the line example? I think Chopped is probably a good example of not reality, but presented in the same format.
Sure.
Because you don't have the same real people from episode to episode.
That is true.
I think you have to have a season-long narrative for it to be like reality TV about the same people in every episode.
Could you make the argument that the specific personalities of the people on the show is particularly relevant? Like what you are watching is the people. And the way that the people are interacting with one another is what makes the show interesting on its whole.
I think that's pretty much it. And often the circumstances under which you're being filmed, like if you're talking about Survivor, most of what you're just watching is them interacting with each other. But there's this overwhelming, the game itself is so present that it forces very unusual interactions out of you.
It's the facilitator.
It's the facilitator, right. Of uncomfortable and backstabby interaction.
It's like a board game, but in real life.
Which are also played in real life. Yeah.
So could there be a board game reality TV show?
I'm 1000% positive you can buy Survivor the board game.
No. But I want to know if there could be a reality TV show where the characters are playing a board game.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
To an extent, there's a 5 bazillion Dungeons and Dragons podcasts and streaming things and stuff like that.
A bajillion.
Easily.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Perfect.
There you go.
Okay. I'm fascinated. I want there to be a mainstream, highly produced board game reality TV show.
I bet this exists and there's a single clear example and you're going to get emails about it nonstop.
Bring it on. If you guys have any feedback for us at all, I love reading your emails. You can send us an email at popcornculturepod@gmail.com or you can follow us on social media for a variety of different ways. On Twitter, I am at @SCB_Ben. Jay is at @JonKerlin. That's at John Kerlin.
Yep.
And what is our Twitter handle? @ApopCast.
ApopCast.
@ApopCast.
Yes.
Yeah, be sure to go and follow us. Or you can just shoot me an email. That's just as good because I do read them. Otherwise, guys, I think that is everything for today. Until next time.
Pop, pop!